Access number 28676, Mr. Jack Bull, Reel 11. Now, anything about or any stories about this period flying on? It's quite a route. I mean, even it wouldn't be much now, but it's quite a lot in those days.
It was a lot in those days, and we did some long legs across from Singapore up to Ceylon. We came back that way, and.
And what was the purpose of the flights? I mean, you were doing the flight, but what were you carrying? Were you passengers?
We were carrying passengers, generally speaking.
What type of passengers?
They had to be sponsored by a government agency, a ministry or something like that.
So they could be civilian or
they
military?
They could be civilians or military.
Government.
Yeah. We carried a lot of military personnel and... Navy, etc. They also had the, on some flights, we had, particularly to Singapore, we had the civilian passengers who were generally businessmen going out to Singapore and being sponsored by a government department. I remember the first trip I did to Singapore, I did with another pilot. He was, I went for experience. And the weather was pretty terrible. The pilot put down the undercarriage at one stage because we were getting bounced around so much. And the passengers were all being sick as dogs. It was a real mess, you know. The passengers wasn't quite like flying today, where you're sitting in a comfortable ship seat and you're on in a pressurized cabin. These aircraft, we didn't have oxygen for the passengers, so we had to go through it. Roughly 10,000 feet, and we got bounced around a lot in the whatever the weather was like. They were very sick, quite frankly. I'm sure we issued sick bags, but it was pretty uncomfortable. I think the seats were just basically canvas covered. There was very little in the way of refreshments. On a 9 or 10 hour flight, you'd probably get a cup of tea and a sandwich with a bit of luck.
Were you enjoying the flights? I mean, you liked flying, didn't you?
I liked flying, yeah. And it was all interesting to me as far as I was concerned. I like to travel and fly, and so I was very happy. The situation, quite frankly, but I don't think the passengers were too happy. But sometimes we carried freight.
Now what sort of freight?
Mainly diplomatic mail. We also had diplomatic mail on board. The freight varied, I'm afraid, just anything that happened to be going that way. Some of it was most unsuitable. Like, I got to the aircraft one morning in India where they were ramming a big electrical transformer, as far as I could see, into the aircraft by shoving it with a lorry, you know, bouncing it off a lorry. So I told him to take it elsewhere. But that was the sort of thing. And sometimes if they didn't have any freight to go, it was a regular service, so that they just had to make up a variety of concrete blocks or something. You know, it was that grim. Generally, I mean, we had aircraft engines or something like that. Or mail. Yeah. Big. It didn't happen to me, but one of the aircraft got. It was carrying a heap of mail, and it had been stacked in the cabin by German prisoners, and they'd concealed three of their members under in an igloo of mail, you know. And they'd do anything to get back to Germany, because we were all the at that time all the Suez Canal business was run by German prisoners, the Afrika Korps, who were the locals held them in terror, of course, so that they had no problem that way, and they did all the loading and transport arrangements. If you wanted a lift, you had to get a German to take. It was a crazy situation, really. But the youngsters that were coming out from the UK as replacements were sort of 18-year-olds, and they weren't really up to it.
Now, any particular stories from this time that you recall? Or was it just fairly routine flying?
Well, it was exciting flying, as far as I was concerned, because the weather was varied, to say the least. You sometimes got diverted to places that were unusual. We went into Istres one time in the south of France, and I'd opted to land at a place called Jiwani in Baluchistan on my way to Karachi, because Jiwani gave me a weather forecast for Karachi which persuaded me to land, and I think they were probably anxious to see new faces around because Jiwani was one of those places in Baluchistan where you know, it was uniformly grey, and you couldn't get a beer, and the water had to be flown in every week. So it was one of these godforsaken places that was an emergency aerodrome, really. There were a lot of places like that down. As I say, it was interesting flying, and you could see the fleets of sailing craft making their way from either to or from India, from the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, and you get tremendous fleets of these things. And in Karachi, when we stayed overnight, we used to go fishing down the used to hire a boat and go fishing and that sort of thing. So it was very pleasant.
Anything else about this
In Cairo, it got a bit dicey later on, because they were sort of rolling grenades at the British forces.
Now, tell us a bit about that. We were aware of that. I mean, did you see signs of it yourself, or was it just the reputation of the place?
No, they switched us to the canal zone because the Egyptians were objecting to British forces in Cairo, I think, use of Cairo Airport. And they were generally getting a bit hostile at that time. We didn't normally come against it, but we had some trouble with the beggars and street traders and that sort of thing. I was walking with my navigator one time, and they started to hassle. He was a very short guy, and they started to hassle us, and we couldn't very well hit back, being officers, etc. And fortunately, some West African troops intervened. They came amongst these guys just like a whirlwind, and sort of held them up against a wall, etc. So we were very relieved at that stage. The West African troops I found were excellent, and they were frequently encountered at places like Tripoli, where they did all the guards, and you took your life in your hands if you tried to get into the aircraft without an officer being present, one of their own officers being present. So they were good, I thought. On the last trip I did.
Now, when would that be? You were there from August 46 to.
September
47,
I think. Yeah.
Now, what about this? This last trip would be in August or September, then, I presume. It doesn't matter much.
I went sick on the last trip. I went to.
And what was your problem?
I had appendicitis. And I spent some time in hospital in Malta. That was in August 47. And I got up in after a night in Habania, which was the main station near Baghdad, and I had this pain in my gut. I didn't want to stay in Iraq, quite frankly, so I didn't go sick, and I went to I was due to fly that night. I felt reasonable, so I went to the aircraft, and we flew down to Egypt, Fayed, and we had a couple of senior officers on board who were route checking. You know, they were reporting on the crew were so we left them at Fayed, and we went on to Luka, where I reported sick. And I spent, I guess, most of August and September, and the beginning of September in there, in the hospital, having my appendix out. And then.
And that's Malta?
That's Malta, yeah, sure.
So what then? Did you go back to the squadron? Or?
Yeah, I went back to the squadron. I took the next aircraft back after on September the 4th, and I acted as second pilot from then on until I was cleared. So most of that was Briars Norton or paratroop exercises, and I worked as a
still based at Lynham.
Yeah, still based at Lynham. Yeah,
but now what were these parachute exercises? Using the Yorks for parachute exercises.
Using the Yorks for parachute exercises. Yeah.
What were the exercises like? They just jump out of the airplane?
Well, they didn't actually jump out, because I don't think they were suitable for jumping out of. We carried the paratroops around on an exercise. There were a lot of paratroops around at the time, and I went to Worthy Down or some place on Salisbury Plain, which I don't quite remember. It's not in my logbook. Where I was liaison officer for the squadron down there, and there was tremendous show they put on down there. You know, 1,000 paratroops dropped out of the sky, and must be the last time they had that many, I think. It was a full-scale exercise, and there were Monty was there, and Lord Tedder, etc. Those are all the big wigs.
This is September still, or would it?
Yeah.
Now, what about demobilisation, or had you become a regular? What was your situation?
No, I'd volunteered for 18 months. They'd initially, when I first joined Transport Command, they wanted volunteers to bring the troops home, so I was happy enough to volunteer. I signed on for another 18 months, past my demob date, you know.
Now, did you ever consider becoming a regular?
Yeah, I was hoping to become a regular.
Now, what happened? So what does happen next? Sorry, I'm getting out of story there a bit.
See, sorry, yeah. I had to be cleared by the Central Medical Board, and I went to London for that, and of course I failed. My eyesight was grim.
Is that what failed you?
Yeah, sure. The eyesight failed, and I wouldn't quarrel with that at all. I was fortunate in as much, you know, I'd done 7 years flying, which and in command of a large and powerful aircraft, so I was, you know.
You didn't take it badly?
Well, I took it badly at the time, I think, but I wasn't resentful at all, because I figured I'd been lucky, you know.
Were you interested in becoming a regular officer in something that didn't need eyesight, or good eyesight, night vision?
Yeah, I thought of it, but I had contacts in Canada, and I thought I would go to Canada, quite frankly. But my father was ill at the time, and so I didn't go.
Now, what about your demob? Were you demobbed from 511 Squadron? Or
yeah, yeah.
When was that then?
I went up to a release centre. I don't know where it was. It was somewhere up in Cheshire, I think.
Now, when was it?
That was I was actually released on the 5th of November, 1947.
So you'd been with 511 till November?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yes. I'd been there. I was there until the day I went up to...
Now, what was the demobilisation process like? I mean, as far as you were concerned, how was it managed?
Oh, it was very reasonable, I thought. It was they gave you a new suit and hat and shoes, I think.
So what was the suit like? Any use in practical terms?
Yeah, it was. I wore it for a long while. It was a double-breasted blue, as I remember, blue stripe. Sort of check pattern, I think. It was quite good. Yeah, it was serviceable anyway. I don't think it was the height of fashion, and you sort of got handed them over the counter. I think they made an effort to get your size right.
Now, what were we going to do? I mean, you know, you'd had 7 years of it, really, hadn't you? And mm-hmm. you hadn't had, you know, you were an officer in the RAF, but you'd been a clerk in an insurance company.
Yeah.
In civilian life, which is a different status, a different world. What did you plan to do when you came out? Go to Canada, but your dad was there. What happened? What were you going to do?
Yeah, well, I was going to go to Canada and find what work I could there. I had contacts in Canada. And
as a pilot or just work?
Just work. I wouldn't. I figured my flying days were over, quite frankly.
This is the eyesight business.
Yeah, sure.
So anybody who gave you a test was going to spot it by then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. There's no doubt about it. I mean, there were two young doctors who tested me at the Central Medical Board, and I heard them say, you know, a typical myope, which short-sighted, I guess. So I was under no illusions about that, and I figured I couldn't get a job flying again.
So what happened?
So when the Canadian thing collapsed, I was, my father was still quite ill, and so I applied to the appointments board, which was a government sort of agency set up to handle officers.
Now, what was the this just RAF officers or all officers?
No, all officers, I think, yeah. Appointments board.
Now, what happened? Well, we haven't heard much about the appointments board. I mean, how did it work? What in your case?
Well, they just sent you after jobs, quite frankly. They gave you a list of jobs, and it was like a labour exchange, really.
What sort of thing did they come up with for you? I mean, was there any sort of discussion about what you were suited and not suited for?
Actually, I'd have liked to have gone to be a dentist or something, but there were opportunities around, and I just wanted to get work at the time, and so I applied to Shell. That was one of the places I was sent to, and they accepted me.
What as?
It was clerk on the personnel side.
Personnel clerk?
Yeah.
So a little bit more than a normal clerk?
I don't know about that.
And how did you take to your new duties? How long did you do it for yourself?
Well, I did it until I retired, actually. I don't know whether I enjoyed some of it, especially the last few years.
What about your acclimatisation to a civilian lifestyle? I mean, how did that go? Because it can be very difficult, especially if you've had a reasonably active and eventful war, which you certainly did. I mean, how did you get used to civilian lifestyle, values, just lack of things happening?
It was difficult to buckle down to it, I think. I managed in the end that it's sort of lost years, if you know what I mean. I don't remember a lot about it, quite frankly.
You don't remember what sort of problems you had settling down?
No, I don't think. I was living at my parents' place at the time, and I got married, and it's the marriage takes over sort of thing, quite frankly.
So it wasn't too bad for you?
No, I don't think so.
Now, what was your career like in that? How did your career go for Shell? Just was your RAF experience or experience as an officer any value?
I think it was, yeah.
So how did your career progress?
It was slow at first. Very slow, indeed. And I got a bit discouraged, but after that, it got to moving, and I got moved around a bit, and I got a few overseas trips, sort of thing.
What did you move into? Were you still in personnel? Or
I was doing. I was in fleet personnel, so I was looking after sailors, in other words, which I found a certain kinship with, You know, I appreciated them, and I think they appreciated me. I hope they did. I still go to reunions with the fleet staff, the captains and chief engineers sort of thing, who have an association, which is pretty active.
Now, what about your connections with the RAF? I mean, are you in any associations? You're in Bomber Command Association, aren't you?
We're in the Bomber Command Association, and I go to a couple of squadron... I go to one squadron reunion, which is my old bomber squadron, and I go to an OTU reunion, which dates from Canada, Boundary Bay, really.
And are the associations important to you? What do they give to you, do you think? Why are they important? Why are you a member? What does it give you?
Yeah, I appreciate them because... I think it keeps old contacts going. We tend to swap yarns, you know. And, I've heard them all several times now. And, but I still like going. I make a point of going. I think the OTU one is going to pack up this year. That's sometime in June. So we go to Stratford-on-Avon, which... stay in a hotel and have a meal, etc. I think that's going to pack up.
And the old comradeship is still there, though?
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yes, I like to think... it's nice to meet these guys, quite frankly.
Did you ever meet up with your crew again, or any of your old crew, particularly the ones you went on the 33 raid with, you know, the others?
Well, you know, what happened was... when we finished the tour, the crew went in all directions, quite frankly. The Australians went back to Australia. The English were dispersed, except for my navigator, who I stayed with. You know, we were together for 3 years, I suppose, from then until the end of the war and to the end of my service. He was still there when I left, and he stayed on in the RAF. He got to squadron leader, I think, or something like that. And then he still lives up in Lincolnshire, and I see him. I try to see him every year. He normally turns up at the service by the monument, but he wasn't there this year, so. I had a word with him, and he's just not well enough to go, you know.
Thank you very much.